Have you ever considered emotion as some kind of energy that can flow around within your body? Also, we are able to learn how to handle these kind of energies, how to train ourselves to deal with our emotions better. So when we experience emotional pain, it does not destroy us. Instead, it nurtures us and help us grow to be a better version of ourselves. So today, we will talk about this type of emotional energy. Hi, I'm Dr. Yishan, a clinical psychologist and board-certified behavioral sleep medicine specialist. Welcome to my podcast. So this emotional energy concept comes from this new book I just received called Energy Rising, written by Dr. Julia DeGangi. Dr. DeGangi is a neuropsychologist and complete her residency at Harvard Medical School, Boston University School of Medicine, and the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. She has a lot of work experience working with leaders at White House Press Office, global companies, and international NGO. So in her work, she has had so much success applying evidence-based treatment interventions to people who suffer from trauma, stress, emotional disturbance. And she put all this research, literature, and clinical experience into this book to help us understand how to deal with our emotions in different ways. So she will join me today and share some insights from her work and this book. Before we get started, I want to take a moment thanking Cozy Earth for sending me a very nice bed set to try. So it's a set of bed sheets with two pillowcases in clay color and looks very pretty on my bed. Also feels so soft at night. I have more than 10 different bed sets, including another Cozy Earth set from last year, and most of them are made in cotton. But Cozy Earth is different. According to their website, they are made from soft and sustainable viscose from bamboo fabrics with some kind of temperature regulating feature. So far, they are my favorite. So after using their different products for the past year and trying this new set for a week, I definitely think, personally, they are softer than my other cotton bed sheets. And when I try to have my electronic blankets on, you know, it's warm. And then other bed sheets used to make me sweaty and sometimes feel too hot and the air cannot really get out easily. But when I try Cozy Earth bed sheets recently, it brings a better air ventilating feature somehow. It's just overall a more cool and comfortable experience for myself. So right now, they are offering a 35% off discount for all my listeners before April 10th. So coupon code is DEEPSLEEP. They also have a 10-year warranty on their products, and you can try their products for 100 nights. If you don't like it, you can send it back for a full refund. I have a mattress with similar policy. I always admire companies offering such kind of policy because that shows me how confident they are with their own product. Hello, Dr. DeGangi. Welcome to Deep Into Sleep podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm so excited to receive your new book.
She's a beauty. Yeah.
Yeah, it's called Energy Rising. I read some chapters in it. It's really a great book. I think a lot of great guidance. So before we get started, just I'm curious, what motivates you to write this book?
God, that's such a good question. Such a big question. So I'm an academic. And I never thought that I would write a crossover book. So I've published pretty extensively in the scientific literature. And I always joke that I'm a Midwest academic. I like to go to 2 good parties a year and then spend the rest of the time like in my office, thinking about my research, thinking about my work, taking care of my patients, taking care of my clients. So I had been approached previously to do some forward-facing things. So for example, to be on a reality show, or someone asked me to do trauma treatment on a documentary. Or so I've always said I could not say no fast enough to these things. It's just, I think they're great for certain people, but it didn't work for me for a variety of reasons. So this book is actually published by Harvard Business Review. And when Harvard Business Review approached me and asked me to write on basically the neuroscience of emotions, the neuroscience of relationships, and the neuroscience of leadership. And I know leadership is a word that has a lot of coding around that word, but we're all leaders of our lives, right? The way we show up in our homes, the way we show up in our careers, the way we show up on social media, we're all leading our own lives. So I took kind of this broad brush to leadership. And when I had this opportunity to really reach so many people and talk about the relationship between our emotions, especially our difficult emotions, and all the things we want in our life, courage, connection, resilience. I was thrilled and I said yes, and it's been an extraordinary journey. So really, I think about the way I talk about my work is I talk about the relationship between the brain, what I call emotional pain, and what I call emotional power.
Great. Those are very important concepts. And also, especially for the emotional pain, I think you cover that somewhat in the book also. I'm a clinical psychologist. So when I treat patients sometimes, I do notice sometimes the emotional pain not only come from the event itself. A big part of it is what we are adding on our shoulder and how we interpret things, how we decide to react to things, or we are trained to react to things in a certain way. And that just makes the pain so hard to tolerate.
You're so right. I mean, so like from one clinical psychologist to another, you know, I think you really hit the nail on the head. You know, first of all, I want to be clear, when I use this term emotional pain, so most of my research has been on trauma. So trauma, PTSD, anxiety, all these conditions that rise out of trauma and stress in our lives. And so when I use this term emotional pain, sometimes I mean absolute trauma, agony, horror, but I'm also using this term emotional pain to capture stress, frustration, irritation, being annoyed, being bothered. Now, people might say to me, well, why? Like, trauma sounds so different. Like, being traumatized, being terrorized sounds so different than being frustrated. So I understand that. But most of my work has looked at these circuits in the brain that give rise to bad feelings. So the part, I always say the brain is the most precious real estate on the planet. For nearly all of us, our brain is less than 3 pounds. So it's not that big. And so you've got to be incredibly efficient with the circuits, with the parts in the brain that give rise to our life. So the parts of your brain that are responsible for your bad feelings, like fear, like anxiety, like irritation, like frustration, like rage, like they're the same parts of the brain. So when we understand how to really work intelligently with our brains, our whole reality changes. You know, one of the things that, depending on my mood, either tickles me or frustrates me is we pay more attention to how to operate our cell phones. We're now ChatGPT. Then we pay attention to the most extraordinary machine that we will ever own, which is our own brains. It's kind of a wild idea to say this, but when we come into relationship with our brain and with our nervous system, our whole lives change. And I'm sure you see this in your work, right? It's like people are spending too much time on social media. They're getting dysregulated. They're staying up too late. They're looking at too many screens. And then how that dysregulates the nervous system, and then how it impairs our sleep patterns, our relationships. It's really quite profound.
Yeah, right. I think from the brain level, we rarely think about it. it's just day to day what we observe, right? A lot of people just thinking about the symptoms and what we see, what we experience, but not many of us understand deep down like how the brain function. And I think it's really cool that you use different angle research. And in your book, you actually guide people. What are some strategies? Because that basically tells us our brain can be trained to do things differently, to wire differently.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we know, you know, that in, to use a fancy term, we know that the brain is neuroplastic. Really what that just means is the brain is responsive to the environment. So how we engage in our lives changes our neurophysiology. And I think that's such a hopeful, hopeful message. You know, and I'm sure you've seen this in your work too. I've worked with people who have been in extraordinary distress. Okay. So a lot of my patient work has been with trauma, and even I do a lot of coaching. So I do a lot of parent coaching, or I do coaching with leaders, or I do coaching, you know, so whether it's on the coaching side or the clinical side, people come to these things because on some level they're in pain. They're saying things are happening in my life that aren't working for me. And they've been this way for a very long time. And so there can be this sensation of hopelessness, like it's never going to get better. And I think the fundamental work of mental health professionals is the installation of hope. Well, okay, would I say, don't worry, you're going to live forever. You're never going to die. You're never going to, nothing, like that's just a lie, right? That's just a hallucination. So when we talk about hope, we actually have to be talking about reality. Part of the reason it's kind of a weird thing to say, but I feel like neuroscience and psychology are so hopeful is because we have so much evidence. People can change their lives in profound ways. And this isn't just theoretical. I work with people all day long, almost every single day, that have come back from really, really like pretty horrible circumstances where they thought there was no hope. The key is to getting to good evidence-based treatment. To getting to treatment that actually works.
Yeah, evidence. I think you mentioned something so important because we often see people, they come in, they're like, like psychology work or this mental health, if you want to recover, you need just to like see the opposite and see positive things, like just to be positive and things will be fine. That's not really true. And but some people have that perception when they're coming in or when they seek help or when they refuse to seek help. They think, you just tell me something nice. I don't need that. But I think that's what friends and family often do. And when you mentioned the evidence-based treatment, that's so important. Can you please explain to the audience what are some evidence-based treatment out there for trauma and what are...
And stress, yeah, trauma, stress, anxiety. So let me actually tell you something that I think is going to be really helpful. So I always think, okay, the brain is giving rise to our consciousness, right? So it's like everything that we're experiencing in our lives at any time is always being filtered through the brain. So if I'm saying the brain is the most extraordinary machine you're ever going to own, I think a really good question is, and I talk about this extensively in Energy Rising, what is the best, like I know what my cell phone is supposed to do. Like how should I think about the machine of my brain? The machine of your brain is best understood. This is so important, and I feel like it's so transformative. Your brain is best understood as a pattern detection machine. Your brain, just like your lungs are meant to take in oxygen and put out carbon dioxide, your brain is in the business of predicting futures. That's literally what the organ of the brain is primarily supposed to do, right? So in other words, what this means is I take data that's happened in my past, that's encoded in my memory systems, and it's making all of these predictions, largely unconsciously, about what's going to happen next. Okay, so in other words, your brain is kind of bringing you through life going, imagine there's like apple, 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 and now your brain comes to a new future. A new day, a new job, a new relationship, a new moment. Well, your brain is going to take past data and predict, and it's going to make a good guess that it should be Apple. Now, a lot of times, this is like wildly adaptive, right? So I know we've all had the experience where we're like driving home from work or wherever, and we end up in our driveway and we're like, I have no recollection of the drive from the grocery store to my, but like somehow I managed to get here, right? Because your brain's kind of on autopilot, making all these really powerful unconscious decisions. So this is amazingly adaptive on a lot of levels. Here's the problem though, when it comes to changing our lives. Change is the literal opposite of a pattern. So if I'm going, my brain is wired to go Apple, Apple, Apple. My brain wants to fill in the blank and say Apple again. So if I'm trying to change now and say, no, it's going to be a watermelon, or it's going to be a banana, or it's going to be a pencil, or it's going to be a dog. You can see how the inertia of the brain is going to go, And if I try to say, no, it's really going to be a banana this time. Can you see how unsettling that is to the nervous system? The nervous system's like, no, something's wrong here. Okay. So why do I say all this? It was really worth investing that time, because here, if I had one word to describe my work, it would be counterintuitive, or it would be opposite. So you asked about evidence-based treatments. A lot of the most evidence-based treatments when it comes to stress, when it comes to anxiety, when it comes even to like, I'd love to hear what you think about CBTI and like how it sometimes is counterintuitive. We're asking people to do what the brain is saying feels a little bit counterintuitive. So let me give you some examples. So anxiety exists on a continuum. We have all these diagnoses, like we have OCD or PTSD or social anxiety or panic or phobia or generalized anxiety. But what we're really understanding more and more is that the same circuits in the brain are involved, and that everyone has some degree of anxiety. Some people have more, some people have less. So when we take a patient, for example, that is afraid of public speaking, or they're afraid of flying, or they're afraid of driving, or they have OCD, or they have PTSD, the treatment actually asks people to do the very thing that their brain is saying don't do. Right? So imagine I had a trauma. I'll use a really extreme example. I had a trauma that happened to me. I've spent my whole life trying not to think about the trauma, trying to avoid places that remind me of the trauma, trying to avoid people that remind me of the trauma, try to avoid conversations. The problem with that, and I'm sure you've seen this a million times, is that never makes people feel better. If it made people feel better, I would say we should all do it. But chronic avoidance is a massive source of pain and stress and anxiety and sleep dysfunction in our lives. So we have to ask the patients. And, you know, obviously we have a strong relationship, we're sharing the evidence, we're making sure they feel as safe as possible to do the very thing that seems like the opposite of what they want to do. Now, the only reason I feel so confident talking about this is because I, number one, understand the scientific literature, and number two, have worked with so many patients who do the thing they've been trying to avoid and get relief. Very, very quickly. I'm talking like they've been avoiding their trauma for a lifetime, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years. And within the span of 2, 3, 4, 5 months, the game has totally changed for them. This is the most powerful, sacred, holy work. I'm, as you can probably tell, I'm so on fire for it.
That's great. And that's hold a lot of hope to help people understand, right? And it's the opposite. Talk about CBTI for sleep treatment. It's actually very similar. But I like how you put it, how you use the science, the literature, the neuroscience to really talk about it this way, that why doing the opposite pattern, it can be so helpful. And when the original pattern does not serve you anymore. For sleep, similarly, you know, when people have insomnia, they tend to do a lot of things to protect themselves, right? Those kind of behaviors to escape the anxiety, they think going to help them to sleep better. They go to bed much earlier. They try to stay on bed much longer. They avoid daily activities, social activities, because they do not sleep well. We are doing exactly the same. We ask them to do the opposite. And a lot of people are like, what? I already have insomnia.
Right. Like, what are you talking about? No, I know, but like, you know that we've all heard that definition of insanity, and we're all guilty of it too, right? It's like insanity is doing the same thing over and over and over and expecting a different result. So you just gave an example with sleep. I gave an example with trauma. Another example, and I'm in my own marriage, so I'm not just talking about the people I serve. I'm also talking about myself. I think what a lot of us are doing in our relationships is we're saying, okay, the strategy I've tried to use to get, for example, my partner to change, it hasn't quite worked yet. So I know what I'll do. I'll do the exact same strategy. I'll just do it more. I'll ask the same questions. I'll have the same conversations. I'll make the same passive aggressive comments. I'll start the same arguments. In couples work, we say the couple has the same fight for 50 years. That's just an example of, and this is, I think, such the healing piece is like, the brain is wired for the familiar. Your brain is not wired to make you feel good. It is wired to find what is familiar. Why? The number one function of the brain is survival. Well, for those of us who want to live vibrant, confident, exciting, joyful lives, survival is like the lowest bar ever. It's like, do you have a heartbeat? Well, at a primitive level, your brain is satisfied if you have a heartbeat, right? Well, for a lot of us, we're like, this is like spiritual death to live this life where I feel so empty, so stressed, right? But what the brain is doing is saying, if the situation is familiar, even if it stressed me out, even if it made me feel miserable, I am certain I can survive. When we truly go into an uncertain territory, whether it's calling a psychologist for the first time, whether it's starting a business, whether it's leaving a relationship or entering a relationship, your brain, again, at an unconscious level, is going to like throw up the warning signs and say, we don't know what's going on here because we've never been here before, and this could potentially be very dangerous. Well, New Year's wasn't that long ago, and I wrote the New Year's essay in the Wall Street Journal. And one of the things I was talking about in the Wall Street Journal piece was, if we want to live lives that really feel good to us, we've got to understand the difference between danger and dislike. That just because I don't like something, like I don't like the way it makes me feel, it does make me feel a little bit anxious. It does make me feel a little bit on edge. It does make me feel, that does not actually mean it's dangerous. And if we think feeling is the your nervous system is literally designed to process hard feelings. That is its function. It's to process all kinds of sensations, some good, some difficult. It's like, I have two kids, you know, like a lot of us gave birth to children. I was like, I understand your body's like, I thought in my mind, like, there's no way my body's going to be able to do this. And my body's like, get out of the way. I know what to do here. Right. And then like these two kids spring out of nowhere. And it was, I thought it was an incredibly painful experience. I'm not going to lie. But like, again, if we think that just because we don't like it, it means it's not possible or it's dangerous, you can see then how narrow and small and unalive we're often going to feel.
Yes. And there's one thing so important is how our brain going to be aware of the patterns. And in my work, I notice build the awareness is a long journey. And just like you said, we are in this autopilot mode for a lot of things day to day, not only drive like to a certain places, but also driving through our lives, doing certain things, or like you said, cannot tell apart what is real danger, what is just dislike of something. I think the awareness is a big piece, and is our brain trainable? Can we train it to really be more aware, to be able to recognize, and then we can do something about it?
Yes. I mean, I don't think therapy would work at all. And I think we're very clear that therapy does work if we couldn't train our brain to see the world differently. It all begins with willingness, right? So you can take, we've all heard the saying, you can take a horse to water, but you can't make a horse drink. So if I'm not willing to believe, if I'm not willing to try to do it different, if I'm not willing to have a new relationship with my feelings of anxiety or rejection or stress or fear, there's not going to be any change. And the other thing too is like, if I already knew the answer, wouldn't I already be implementing it? In other words, like, in order for me to be different, I've got to learn new things. Tell me one thing that you've learned that you didn't already know where there wasn't some discomfort. Whenever I get a new computer, it's annoying. If I have to change banks, it's annoying. If you want to learn how to salsa dance, or you want to learn how to computer code, or you want to speak a different language, or even if you move to a different place where they speak the language, it's like, you got to learn all these new systems. It's like, it's so interesting to me that in all other domains of our life, we understand that learning, like you start a new job, it's annoying to like go through all the onboarding and learn the systems and get the logins and get, it's a lot of work, right? But we totally understand that this is just life. I think there's something that happens to us on the emotional health side, what I call emotional power, where we forget this. And the reason I think that this is such a worthwhile conversation to have is your entire relationship with your life is predicated on emotional energy. The biggest questions you ask about your life: was it good? I don't know. How do you feel about it? Was I a good parent? I don't know. How do you feel about it? Should I stay in the marriage? Should I leave the marriage? Do I make enough money? Do I have enough time? Is my life too hard? Is my life too easy? Am I doing enough? These, I mean, all of these questions are fundamentally mediated by emotional processes in the brain. When I say emotional energy, the reason I wrote energy rising is I'm not speaking metaphorically and I'm not speaking metaphysically. I'm talking neurobiologically. Your emotions are neuroelectrical signals that are guiding your behavior, your relationship, basically guiding your life. So emotional intelligence is something I think a lot about. And the more of an intelligent relationship we can have with these sensations in our own body, the more extraordinary our life gets to become.
That's where the energy comes from. Because I was looking at this book, I really like a lot of analogies you use and the words you use, like energy. And we think about energy flowing around in the body and in the brain. And in ancient culture, we talk about energy a lot, but it's the first time I ever consider energy linked to, emotions.
Oh yeah. The only reason I can do my fMRI and EEG research, all my scientific research, is because of the electrical and chemical properties of the brain. Like, the brain is quite literally an electrical machine, right? It's sending these impulses at 260 miles an hour. There's like 100,000 chemical reactions taking place every second. Again, the reason that we have neuroimaging technologies is it's indisputable that the body runs on the body, the nervous system, the brain runs on energy.
Yeah. And you give a lot of strategies in the book, which is great.
I did.
Yeah, a lot of steps totally make sense. You have charts, you have examples. I think the whoever read the book gonna really benefit a lot. I actually want to let my clinical therapist to really read this book. I think it's a good way.
I've had a lot of clinicians refer the book to their patients.
Yes.
And say, like, their patients got tremendous benefit from it. And I think that makes sense because I am myself a clinician. The other thing I often say is I am a ruthless pragmatist. So Energy Rising is very, I think it's interesting. I think it's a very beautiful book. I also think it's very practical. Here's a funny story for you. When my editor first asked me to work with him and said okay, what's the vision you have for the book? I was like, all right, I'm going to think about this. So I was like, what do I want for Energy Rising? Which we did not know was going to be called Energy Rising at that point in time. But I came back to him and I said, okay, so I came up with two words, just two. And he's like, great, that's going to be really, sounds really simple. And I was like, the two words I want to really have this experience feel like the book, I want the book to be like this, is number one, beautiful. And number two, practical. And he was like, that's kind of a strange combination. I think we think of beauty as this aesthetic or this poetry, and it can be a little bit ephemeral and just kind, and practical is very we're down to business, 1, 2, 3, let's get it done. So I think a lot of times those things don't go together. But I do think that we did an extraordinary job with Energy Rising, really creating a book that is both beautiful and practical.
Yeah. So hopefully people can really read the book, use the strategies you wrote in your book to help them start facing things differently. And again, all this power and energy expansion in themselves. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you so much.
So I hope our conversation brings some hope to you and empower you to know that you are capable of dealing with your emotions. And there are great tools we will discuss in our next episode. And she will give us some really good strategies, how to work on those and how to think about those in more details. Again, if you like Dr. Diganji's work, please check out her new book, Energy Rising.
Sleep is an individual thing. We all sleep differently, and there is so much we can do to improve sleep quality. Keep hope and carry on. This podcast is for general informational purpose only and does not include the practice of medicine or other health professional services. Usage of the information we share is at the listener's own risk, and our content does not intend to be a substitute for any medical and professional services, diagnoses, and treatment. Please seek professional health services as needed.